proceeded to respond to that, made a very good point, sir.
Well, I'll respond to all the points. Your point about the hereditary monarchy. I did say the transition from feudalism to capitalism took place over 300 to 400 years. Of course, there are elements of feudalism still with us, namely the unelected, unaccountable monarchy, the House of Lords, and the ongoing aristocratic system. These are all residues of a feudal system that's still to this day, in the 21st century, with us. To me, the hereditary monarchy is, in many respects, the acme of the class system. It's the very high, the pinnacle of the undemocratic nature of so many of our state institutions. To me, monarchy is not compatible with democracy. The idea that just because you're born into one particular very privileged family, that you can therefore be out of the state, that is really offensive. The idea that the most stupid, ignorant, immoral Windsor family member can be our head of state, whereas the wisest, most moral commoner cannot, that is just not compatible with any sense of democracy. I agree with the point about the media. Yes, the media has a lot to answer for, but of course, at the end of the day, when people organise and campaign, they can win despite the media. In the 1980s, the media was pretty friendly to Margaret Thatcher, but millions of people in this country decided the poll tax was unfair. Hundreds of thousands protested, hundreds of thousands either refused to pay or delayed their payments. The people decided that despite the media, this system was unfair. And at the end of the day, Margaret Thatcher, who said the poll tax was non-negotiable, was forced to find out. Not that the replacement is much better, but the point is, that system, that hated system, was eventually replaced by the power of people. And I would say the campaigning for poll tax is one of the great, great examples in modern times of people power in this country. In terms of Venezuela, I think the phrase, the revolution betrayed, pretty much sums it up. I don't think the Chavistas have ever been really socialists. They've been demagogues, populists. You know, they have instituted some good programs, but they've also been implicated in lots of very, very bad things. The way in which the Chavistas attack their enemies, baiting them as Jews and gays, this is just pure fucking bigotry. And how any socialist can support a party that tolerates that kind of homophobia and anti-Semitism is just beyond me. And of course, the muzzling of the media, the shooting dead of peaceful protesters in recent weeks, condemned and documented by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, this has nothing whatsoever to do with socialism. It is about a party elite struggling to maintain their own power. And, you know, I have no great grief for the opposition, but there are, of course, many left critics of the Chavistas who support the idea of genuinely free elections, a genuinely free media, genuine right to protest and freedom of expression. In terms of the Fraud Act, I wasn't holding up as being the be-all and end-all. I was simply saying there were mechanisms there which could have, perhaps with some difficulty, but not impossibly, been used to prosecute those bankers. Far better to have an explicit offence that I've outlined of criminal recklessness and negligence. Far better to make it absolutely explicit and clear and give the guidelines and the remit to ensure that it's possible to be enforced. The reasons why the Fraud Act was not invoked was, I suggest, because the people running the FSA are in cahoots with big business. Many of them are drawn from big business. They're their friends and their allies. I don't want to entirely suggest that it was a stitch-up, but many people did come to that conclusion. But how could the FSA, staffed and appointed by people from business backgrounds, what likelihood or possibility was that they would ever act against their own colleagues? Your point about baby steps have been tried and haven't worked. I disagree. Baby steps have never been tried in this country. You name for me a left-wing party in this country, despite its left-wing name, that has ever argued for the structural reform of capitalism. I can't know of any. I don't know of any. I can't recall any. What they've suggested is defensive measures like increased wages or improved health and safety or those kind of bread and butter type issues. Very good at that, but not in terms of structurally reforming the system, which is what my four proposals, imperfectly and immodestly, are trying to do, to actually change the system. So, in my view, there have been no serious attempts by any left or trade union group in the last 100 years in Britain to structurally change the system. It's all been revolution or nothing, or merely welfare type reforms, which have not actually changed or sought to change the fundamentals of how the system operates.
The socialist vision of society has as its starting point an unqualified opposition to all bigotry, all prejudice, all nationalism, all racism, all homophobia. So we have come from it, we agree on this. But to take this further, Peter mentioned a little earlier about creating jobs and so on. The socialist goal is not to create jobs, just the opposite. We actually want to end the system of employment. Socialist vision for society is for each according to ability, to each according to needs. That's not a system of wage slavery. That's a system of owning the earth in common and having free and equal access to all of its resources. And that's the vision that's very compelling and important, one that we don't give up, and one that we actually regard as practical and realisable immediately, provided the majority understand and want it. That's what our work is geared towards. Just very briefly, in relation to two or three of these points, our friend here mentioned Foucault and so on. Of course, understanding the way social power is obtained and is hung on to is very important. But in the present context, the most powerful weapon, the most enduring way in which power is hung on to with the present level of education of the working class is through consent. There are cases all around us of proof of repression, we're aware of that. But in the longer term, and in the universal context of international, in the world, in the global context rather, consent is what this is really about. And people are consenting, or have been consenting, with various degrees of passivity to a set of property relationships, which is what capitalism is all about. So tying this up with our other friend who talked about our brains being marinated and so on by the education system and the media, there's a huge, vast resources are being ploughed into keeping this system where it is. On two fronts, repression and propaganda. And we were asked a little earlier about causes for hope. Can I throw this back to that point as well, actually? One of the main causes for hope that we have is simply to observe the desperate measures, the vast amounts of resources that the ruling class feels necessary to put into this constant work they have to do of persuading people to give their consent to a fundamentally rotten system.
Socialist ideas are very easy for people to understand. We know a lot about the world we live in at the moment, all the problems that there are for people. But what the socialist speaker has been talking about tonight is people taking control of their own lives and the lives of society, and people taking over the resources of the world so that they can be used for everyone. And that taking over is carried out in a thoroughly democratic way, in which people know what's wrong with society as it is now, know what they want that will be run in their interests, and how to get it through majority understanding and democracy. Now, the problem is, as I see it, and I think probably many people here see it, is that if you were to go outside this hall and you started asking, and you started to ask people of London whether they'd heard of a socialist case and describe what the case is, The overwhelming majority, I think we can guarantee, if we were honest here, would have never heard of it before. They would think that they heard of it, but the problem is that we have, on the one hand, reformist ideas that we've heard from one side tonight about putting people, workers' representatives on boards, and punishing capitalists who've been perhaps a little bit too naughty, and all things like that which have been tried time and time again and have led nowhere. On the other hand, the other anti-capitalist measure, which has led nowhere, has been minority action in countries such as Russia and China and in Eastern Europe, where a small group of leaders have got together and have thought they've known how to lead people to a utopia, which, as we all know, if we were honest, lead to anything remotely resembling a utopia, precisely the opposite. So the point that I'm making here is that people are perfectly able to understand what is a very simple idea if it is put forward to them in a straightforward way. The reason why it's been difficult is because socialism has been misrepresented by reformists who, for all the time they might have used the word socialism, what their ideas have just ended up reforming the same old failed system that we've got, or they've used dictatorial methods. The third way is surely the most attractive way, which we talk to people, explain to them that there is an opportunity, that there is a way of achieving it through mass understanding and democratic action.
This can seem very simplistic, but it seems to me that you're both heading towards something. If you combine what you both believe in, we'd have strategy and we'd also have an end result, you know, which is that it would be changing the way that people view things. And I developed a teeth with going to meetings and discussions where people were all arguing the pros and cons. And I think that, you know, it's now is a time when people are looking, I think, using the media, all these other things, when people are looking for change. And sometimes they want to bury their head in the sand, not to see what change is, but they're uncomfortable, we need change. And I don't understand why we keep going through all this. I mean, we get together and build up a strategy that's going to work, whereby we incorporate things that Beatrice saying that will make change. We go and demonstrate about it, then we see whether it's going to work or it's not going to work. We take it on. In the meantime, what we're doing is we're educating people as well. I mean, I think we need some strategy, you know, we need to move on.
Yes, I mean, I sympathise with your notion of despair of people who seem to be coming from roughly the same direction and yet are failing to join forces. And of course, there is an urgency about the situation. However, I can answer your point very simply as to why, in the present moment, for example, Peter and myself are not going to leave this hall as part of the same movement as yet. And that is because Peter is coming here and proposing, for example, more laws. Socialist Party is proposing abolishing all laws. They're quite opposite propositions, in fact. And Peter is coming here proposing that we actually modify the complex systems of ownership which exist. The Socialist Party is coming here and proposing that we abolish all ownership.
But you're not going to get there, right?
Oh, well, this is the point, you see. I'm glad you throw that back at me. To simply say we're not going to get it is a statement that's without any substance or proof whatsoever. I mean, mean, what you're saying basically is that the human endeavour has to be stopped before it started, because we have to have what we do have. And if human beings had accepted that attitude of mind, then of course we would never have made any of the progress that humankind has made over the centuries. So if I may be permitted to deal with your point, since you have asked us, the socialist proposal does have a strategy as well as an end goal. The strategy is that we need to build an educated majority. We need to have, as somebody said a few minutes ago, mass consciousness. And who knows, perhaps tonight's conversation, tonight's debate rather, is some small part of that. People are educating themselves, they are educating one another. And of course, one of the biggest educators is experience. People are responding to the oppression that they perceive themselves as suffering. They are trying to do things about it, but they're struggling towards finding what the solution might be. Those of us who are here particularly concerned about these solutions have spelled this out very clearly. What does socialism actually mean? It means that instead of having a small minority owning and controlling wealth, production of wealth, instead the whole of society would share through common channels, through democratic mechanisms, in operating that productive machinery to meet human needs. Now, what's the problem with that? Why can't we have that? There's one reason why we can't have that at the moment, and that is that there is armed force being used on behalf of less than 1% of the population to protect the world's wealth from the rest of us. And as far as we're concerned, as socialists, simply as human beings, we have to stop that, and that has to be our only objective at the present moment.
The speaker here said that socialism is easy. Well, if it's so easy, why isn't there a public majority in favour? Why aren't we there already? I agree that logically and rationally, in every respect, socialism makes sense. But we haven't won the argument. I agree we should educate the majority. But socialists have been doing that in this country for 150 years, and support for socialism today is even less than it was in the past. I'm not saying this to dampen your enthusiasm, just to be realistic. Just to be realistic about what is possible. It's not that I don't share the dream, I do. I agree with the long-term objective. It's just that I have a different vision about how we're going to get there, based on where public consciousness is right now. And the difficulty, given the media and other instruments in our society, of convincing and persuading people. The sad reality is that right now, the public is moving to UKIP, not to the left of the Green. And we have to wake up to that fact. And we have to think about what is it that we're doing wrong, what is it we're not doing enough of to change that.
Thanks. Just going on with what this lady said, I think it's really important for us to not be content to stand in the sidelines and just share ideas with like-minded people. We've all got the same goals in mind, but I think what you're decrying is baby steps from Peter Satchell, and not baby steps. They're actually optimistic, but they're achievable. I think that approach will get us a lot further than, you know, infighting, saying unless we get everything, unless we get it now, then nothing else is good enough. That will get us anywhere, and we all want the same thing. We need to find a way that's going to actually get us there.
I'm kind of disappointed really in Big Tatchel, because as a human rights campaigner, I would expect him to know more about this to be human. Let me explain. All societies, no matter what they've been, what they are, they will be human relationships. So it follows, logically, that the more you know about what you're relating with, the more you know about who you're relating to, the more human, the more functional that relationship will be. If we look at us human beings, let's find something out about we argue about bioarchaeology, biology, genetics. We distill that information. These sciences are curious. Then we can only come to one conclusion, and that is we all share the same ancestors, so therefore we are all members of a family, of one human family. That's a fact. Now, in a family that functions as a family, mustn't it? It's to be a family. The ethics follow is from each according to ability to each according to need. Now, if we look at our society today, we can look around and our society is totally dysfunctional because we do not acknowledge who we are as human beings, as members of one family, compared to cooperate with one another on that basis. And this idea that working people can't understand socialism, what it is that only they could understand socialism if they wasn't carried by the perceived lack of power. Now, what politicians don't tell you, is where the power in society lies. They're not going to have this. Every bit of society's power lies with us. Why is it not with us? Because we do all the work. Capitalists do none of it. Us do all the work. So, once we decide on something as a majority and we go for it, there's not power on earth to stop it. We are the power in society. So, if we were to recognise our common identity as members of the human family, there's something amazing about that. Is that you cannot exploit, coerce, or oppress, or abuse in any way those people you identify. You cooperate. And that all the option there is in a rational, logical world, human world.
We'll take one more comment. So, here's at the back, here's at the head up of the
White Shirt Reflective. Make it goody. I just wonder whether Peter reflected on, given the reforms that he's outlined tonight, reflected on the fact that the tendency within capitalism for decades has been towards the marketisation and commodification of everything, not the other way around.
Yes, there is a commodification of everything. I remember this quote by Jean Coca-Cola, this French filmmaker, and he says, we're all children of Marx and Coca-Cola. And I think that capitalism and consumption are so interrelated ideologies, they're interrelated structures, they're intertwined. So when we talk about socialism and everyone working together for common needs, I would like to say, what is this need in this age when there is no real distinction between needs and wants? Scarcity and modernity, what are these needs that we're looking towards?
Do you want to respond to that comment before doing the next sentence?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll respond to that comment before we have a couple of statements.
The idea of a rigid distinction between needs and wants itself has proved to be a somewhat dubious political ploy, because in actual fact, how do people have their desire informed if not through their needs? The fact is that the need for food, clothing, housing, shelter, all of these things are realizable. And this is what people want. So I would say that it was actually a false distinction in the first place.
I just say that wants and needs, they're constantly evolving. Years ago, centuries ago, needs and wants were very small, were very diminished by comparison to today. As cultures and civilizations evolve, so do needs and wants. And I would make a distinction between, I may want to be a millionaire, but I don't really need to be a millionaire to be happy. I think that much of the orthodox approach to economics has been about growth and GDP to the neglect of what actually makes people happy. And of course, people need a basic substance of food and clothing and shelter, education, healthcare. But beyond that, a lot of these needs, a lot of these wants, perhaps not what maybe 2,000 million people on this planet would regard as needs and wants.
I think we're going to take a few more. And I think there's a woman that has a we take a comment from you, and then the one in front.
Thank you. I'm not too sure about that confused about, it's not from the loaded language. I'm not too sure we need to call things brutal or be too personal. Especially if it's a conflict, but I think finding the intentions for each of them are very personal and local. Abolishing laws, do we really want to abolish laws? It's comes back to the fact that people who seem to cause a lot of the problems with their own life, they're bullies, basically. If we want to feel like that for themselves, do we not want laws to keep people like these charitable characters in systematic ways? I think we would like to abolish ownership. I would like to see them on my plate tomorrow. I'd like to put them in my house tomorrow. Probably maybe redefining what we mean by ownership. We don't take steps to get places. We get anywhere. We might just pull ourselves somewhere. What do we mean by capital too? I mean, just with the word itself, we might mean a combination of potential energy that can be used for something else, with absolutely no ability to accumulate potential energy. Things
hospitals, health, education, transport,
That's what it is. But people cannot have, all the people cannot own other people's house. I can have a house, there is a summer house, but I cannot have a house where you live. First, we should go after this. And also, people cannot have someone else, where he's working, at a restaurant or coffee shop, whatever it is. There shouldn't be a landlord. Anyone having his own shop should belong to that person. A few years ago, I read in a newspaper from London to Exeter, 64 different trading prices. So that shows how much it's necessary transport should be belong to the government. I think if you go after this sort of things, you can make a big step rather than doing it with the very steps which is somewhere. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think it's going to conclude the discussion part of today. What I'm going to do is invite our speakers to respond to some of the things that have come up during the discussion as well as to each other's thoughts in their closing statements. So, Peter, are you okay to start with your closing statement?
I'd like to thank Clifford and all of you for participating in this discussion tonight. There's been a lot of very interesting, useful, controversial, and non-controversial contributions, which add to the mix, and you're right that we need to have debates like this to explore alternatives, to debate how we get there, to discuss potential strategies. So thank you to all of you for being part of this evening. I just would like to finish fairly briefly, just to reiterate that my point that, to me, socialism is about the extension and enhancement of democracy, and in particular, the extension of democracy into the economic sphere. My proposals tonight are not about sustaining, maintaining, or managing capitalism, but introducing a series of reforms that can help structurally transform capitalism, to change it, to move it away from where it is in the direction of where we would like to see society move to. I think that historically, in many, many examples in many different countries, that winning small gains, and perhaps you may see these proposals as very small gains, but winning small gains is often a great motivator. It enthuses and empowers people. It gives them confidence. We can win this cause. We have won this cause. Now let's try and win this cause and that cause as well. So what I'm saying is, I'm trying to move the debate around policy away from welfareism and wages and salaries, those things that are reforms within capitalism, to a series of reforms about transforming and changing capitalism. And in the process, I would hope that people winning these changes will then feel confident, or more confident, that further change is possible. That this can be the first of many steps that will lead us to the kind of vision that has been espoused tonight.
Yes, thanks to all of you for coming along tonight, and thank you very much in particular to Peter Tatchell for coming and taking part in the debate with us. I'd like to start in winding up just by dealing briefly with some of the questions that were accumulating a short while ago. And we have Fred down here who was asking a few questions directed at me in particular about using certain language and using strong language. I make no apology for that. There are things happening to people around us, and there are things happening to us which language struggles with express. The levels of pointless suffering, irrational suffering that's going on around us. And I hope I haven't used any ad hominem arguments. I haven't actually made any personal comments to Peter or anybody else, but I do reserve the right to make very strong comments about political ideas, whoever it may be is expressing them. I make a distinction between the political ideas that I've been rude about and the person who was expressing them, because of course the person is free at any time to stop expressing those political ideas. They're not irrevocably attached to that person, if you see what I mean. As far as abolishing laws and about bullies and so on, it's not capitalism's laws that are protecting us from bullies, quite the opposite. What we're trying to abolish is property relationships. That doesn't mean getting rid of the right for you to have the clothes on your back, or the room that you're in, or the house that you're in. We're talking about a situation in society where property is enshrined. We're talking about major wealth. We're talking about productive resources being owned and controlled by a very, very tiny number of people. And both Peter and myself, at the beginning of the evening, came in with this figure about 1,000 people who control nearly £500 billion worth of wealth and so on. It's hard to lose track of what this means, but it's a good way in to looking at how society is currently structured. The socialist alternative is actually a world without money. It's a world of free access to wealth. What could be more exciting than that? A world of pure democracy, which we all take part in making decisions, producing wealth, and have free access to that wealth which we've produced. As I said earlier, baby steps. This is a sort of phrase that's come up many times tonight. And we have nothing in principle against small steps towards a large aim. The problem is, it just doesn't seem to work that way. There have been all kinds of reforms discussed, tried, voted upon, even introduced over many, many years of capitalism. One thing we learn, however, is that capitalism as the present social system is not very malleable. It's not very changeable. It can change its colours the way a leopard predicted its spots, or it can change its face. The actual mechanism of capitalism is deeply rooted in the need to make profit, the need to accumulate surpluses, the need for investment to produce a surplus for a small minority who are already very powerful. There are certain key features of capitalism. And so the problem that exists with Peter's proposals, like any reform program, is that it's an attempt to make a given social system work in a way which it simply cannot do. In that sense, it's utterly unrealistic. Now, the socialist alternative may appear to some people to be unrealistic in the sense that it's a big change, it's a big aim. But ultimately, it's by far the more realistic option facing us here and now. We've got to stop pretending that the system we have can work in any other way than that which it does. We have to acknowledge realistically that it has to go. So I'm saying that although capitalism is not changeable, it can't be changed in its essence. However, it is replaceable. It is replaceable, but not changeable. Not modifiable in any realistic way. If you were being regularly mugged on the same street each night on your way home, how would you take to somebody suggesting that you start to cooperate with your mugger, negotiate with your mugger, discuss with your mugger? This is what this is about tonight. And that's why we feel that it's very urgent for us to consider instead the alternative, the socialist alternative, in which that whole process of legalised robbery, which billions of people are being subjected to day by day, has to be brought swiftly and smoothly to a close. And the only way that's going to happen is if a majority of people educate themselves, develop majority consciousness, understanding the system, and are able to voice their decision that it's time to reject that system utterly, that it can't be made to work for us, and we have to replace it with a socialist system of common ownership, democratic control of all productive resources.